Please remember, the views and opinions expressed by this show or any other show on DV Radio and its guests are strictly those of said individuals and do not reflect those of the DV Radio staff, nor the staff of Dysfunctional Veterans.
Hello and welcome to the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog. I'm your host, Joaquin Watai. I'm beginning this show in order to continue to spread the word about PTSD service dogs in general, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and just various aspects of service dog life.
How do you deal with the adversity that can occur when somebody objects to the presence of your service dog?
Focus on your dog.
A service dog cannot be a protector. Many handlers don't know what they can't do.
The Service Dog Show with PTS Dog right here on WDVR DV Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog. I'm your host, Joaquin Watai. With me today is Bart Sherwood, founder and director of TADSAW, Train a Dog, Save a Warrior. How are you doing today, Bart?
I'm doing fine, Joaquin. How are you doing? Thank you for having us on your show. And also thank you for your sacrifice and service to our country and to our veterans that you're reaching out to.
Well, thank you. Let's talk a little bit about TADSAW. Just so the audience knows, Bart and I are friends, and we have conversations several times a week. So we tend to get off into the bushes. But I'm going to try to keep us focused here and talk a little bit about, first of all, How did TADSAW come about?
TADSAW came about in the middle of July in 2010. I was with a therapy dog organization called Pennies from Heaven, and we were doing some therapy dog work at the Warrior Family Support Center at Fort Sam Houston. And one of the little girls, a soldier's daughter who had gone through, who's in elementary school, saw Kelsey, the therapy dog from Pennies from Heaven. And Kelsey was a reading education assistance dog, and she came running over and sat down next to Kelsey and was petting her and telling her how much she loved her and how much she made school fun for her and was able to read. She went from a second grade reading level to a fifth grade reading level in the year that she read with Kelsey. And her father, who was a active duty sergeant first class, came walking up and looked down at his daughter and Kelsey and said, "Gee, I wish my dog could do that." And I looked up to him and said, "Train a dog, save a warrior." And that's how it was born. It was around the middle of July, about the 20th of July or 24th of July. And it's been nonstop since. He was our first active duty and first applicant into the program, and with his dog, Coco, and they did great. I mean, it showed that, you know, the soldier himself was capable of training a dog. And because of being a 20-year veteran of the military, you know, still active and med boarding out, it became evident that this may be the way to go and pursue training service dogs for veterans by allowing the veteran or the active duty soldier be part of the training process rather than training a dog and giving it to them, and, you know, which is a lot slower process. So we've really gone forward with that thought in mind of making it better training for the veteran to be involved with, and also reaping the benefit of having the dog, whether it's a personal dog with an established bond for the family, or finding a new dog coming out of a rescue shelter between the ages of 14 months and 5-6 years of age. That way the dog was, you know, fully developed as far as his sense of smell and his, as far as being an adult dog. And so since 2010, we've been actively training, you know, service dog teams across the country.
Now let's talk about that a little. You personally are in Texas, but TADSAW is nationwide.
Correct.
How?
Have you ever tried telling no to a veteran on the other line? Tell him you can't help him because you're not in the same state he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow when you served and you were aboard the, you know, your ship, whatever they asked you to do while you were serving, you did. Mm-hmm. That was the job. You know, that's what you signed up for. And being committed to a program, I'm not going to set a limit on who I'm going to take care of and who I'm not going to take care of. It's hard sometimes in the fact that there isn't a trainer in the area or close enough to that veteran to be able to get him into the program quickly. So we try to go ahead and find trainers within a 60 to 90 minute driving radius, if we can, of that veteran's home. And, you know, we're successful a lot of times or unsuccessful other times, but it's we're trying out there and giving the veteran, you know, the hope that if we can make everything go, that he's going to get a service dog. Mm-hmm. You know, it's keeping those trainers focused that are helping veterans on their mission, which is take care of the veteran first and foremost. This is the person we're trying to save from possibly a suicide down the road because he's not getting any kind of assistance for his well-being. But the dog seems to be able to fulfill the role of clinician, therapist, forward observer, alert. You know, you and I talk about this all the time. I prefer to call the service dogs in our program medical alert service dogs. I don't like calling them PTSD service dogs. I don't like calling them psychiatric service dogs because I don't feel, because the label that's already been placed upon the soldier, the service member, as far as having a mental health, mental illness issue in PTSD or whatever, they're not mentally ill. They just have a situation that mimics maybe mental illness behavior, mental health issues, but by far is not mentally ill. He's very rational, and because of that, we feel that he can go ahead and learn how to train a dog. Mm-hmm. When you went in the military, whereas most people that went in the military had no idea, they knew which end of the gun probably the bullet came out of and which end of the gun went into your shoulder, but they didn't know how to take it apart and put it back together, clean it and put it back together again so they could fire it and have it a piece of the successful equipment. And so we feel that by training the dog from start to finish, that service member, that veteran, gets the knowledge of how to take care of his dog. So if he has to replace his dog, he has all the knowledge necessary to train the dog. He has the tools. And we're giving them a hand up, not a hand out. Mm-hmm. So they have to work for it. And many, many of the veterans that apply to the program drop out because it's too much work. Those that succeed and complete the program are much better off because they completed their mission, which was to get a service dog. Mm-hmm. But the dog alerts them when they're triggered. It's not a we look for the active dog, not a reactive dog. We want a dog that's going to go ahead and alert the veteran when they are triggered for an episode and the release of adrenaline and cortisol and neurotransmitters occur. And by teaching the veteran to understand and read the dog's body language, much like as a part of a squad where you have a forward observer, you have to look and know what the hand signals are of that forward observer to know what to do, to be reactive. And so training the veteran to understand the dog's body languages allows him to be proactively responsive to the dog when he is triggered and to go ahead and take care of the situation. Mm-hmm. No different than a detection dog, a bomb detection dog, or a narcotic detection dog, or a contraband detection dog. If the handler doesn't know the signals that the dog is giving him for what he's smelling for, he's going to drag the dog away because he has no idea, with the dog saying, hey, there's something here, look, it's inspected. And this is why some dog teams, military dog teams, get injured, because evidently the dog knows where a live IED is, and the soldier's not paying it, the handler's not paying attention, and, you know, boom, they step on it and get hurt. Mm-hmm. So it's knowing how to read that dog's body language is extremely important to being a successful service dog team, medical alert service dog team. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And we've talked about this exhaustively. The actual process of training your own service dog with the assistance of a TADSAW trainer helps the veteran to develop self-confidence, confidence in his dog and his dog's abilities to alert him, tools to deal with situations, you know. Perfect example, I'm guilty of this. I will, in a difficult situation where I've got Skeeter and it's just too much for me, use Skeeter as the reason why I have to leave. I'm sorry, but he needs to go potty, so I've got to take off. You know, things like that. It gives the veteran a whole new toolbox of ways to process their, for lack of a better term, and we'll get to this because I know what you're going to say, to process their PTSD, process what's going on in their heads, and then find constructive ways to redirect themselves. You know, usually it's to focus their energy back onto the dog rather than what's stressing them and creating the potentially triggering event. But let's talk about your idea about the difference between PTSD and a new term you have coined.
Well, the term that I coined, I call it MIAD, Military-Induced Anxiety Depression Syndrome. I think it's more realistic of what it occurs because it affects all members of the military, combat engaged, non-combat engaged, supportive personnel, whoever's around any part of the military. I guess I started thinking about this a while ago because we had a applicant who was not diagnosed with PTSD, but his doctor did indicate that he had combat-related anxiety depression.
Mm-hmm.
Not PTSD, but he had combat-related anxiety. And, you know, they want to keep changing these statistics because nobody wants to have more a higher incidence of PTSD. So they look for ways of walking around it, not calling it a zebra. Mm-hmm. You know, call it a horse with a big, thick mane or an ugly head, got stripes, you know. But it's still a zebra at the end of the day. And like I said, with the occurrence in just our general public of shootings at malls, shootings in schools, shootings in office buildings, the survivors of these attacks have PTSD, but nobody looks at them as, oh, wow, they were a victim of a school shooting. They're going to come after us and shoot us. They look at them with a sense of sympathy that, wow, that's really a shame what happened to them. We need to feel sorry for them and take care of their needs. And yet, when you look at a professional service member, soldier, who's gone through war, and you hear that he's got PTSD, the first thing you do is run, hide, they're going to kill us. They're going to shoot us because they think we're the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not the enemy. So if we're going to go ahead and start having a greater incidence of PTSD, then we need to remove the military from it and call it an occupational related hazard. When I talk to firefighters or first responders and I talk about the MIAD, the Induced Anxiety Depression Syndrome, they say that's exactly what we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've recognized it. They still call it PTSD, but they would rather call it an occupational hazard because they can treat it. They can take care of it better.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can look for something other than a drug to take care of the symptoms.
Right, right.
When the drugs don't work, because you're using the side effect profile of the drug rather than the mechanism of action and the actual indication of the drug. And I guess I should step back out of the role of being the founder of TADSAW and let everybody know that I'm a registered pharmacist and I've been dispensing drugs, you know, as a pharmacist since 1977 after going to pharmacy school. So I do understand the mechanism of drugs. I understand what they're using them for. But if you're treating symptoms only, then you're only using the side effect profile of what the drug is. You're not using the mechanism of action
mm-hmm.
of where it's really working. And this is why the drugs don't work. This is why the doctors are so expedient on increasing the dosage when something doesn't work. If it doesn't work on a small dose, most likely it's not going to work on a bigger dose except for the side effect profile. Mm-hmm. So this is where, I guess, you know, the rubber hits the road. Am I a pharmacist first, or am I looking for something that's going to take care of the needs of the veteran? And well, I'm looking at the needs of the veteran, not the needs of the medical community.
Yeah. But you bring up an interesting point. Psychiatric medications treat symptoms. The service dog treats the person. And there's a difference.
Well, some drugs do treat the person when there's a definite deficiency of a chemical, mm-hmm. thought to be active in the thought process or in proper functioning of the brain is missing or lacking, or mm-hmm. the uptake not taken back up. It's a lot of philosophical, theoretical type medicating and what the drug does. You know, the worst thing, I always laughed whenever I saw a new drug and somebody said, well, what's the mechanism of action? And the drug company says, it's thought to be this, but we're not sure. Mm-hmm. Or a mechanism of action unknown. But we do know that symptoms for a medical condition and symptoms for something else can often be confusing. Mm-hmm. Like a cold in an allergy. You know, sometimes you're confused whether it's a cold or an allergy, you know, what's causing it. But they're treated basically the same way with antihistamines or decongestants. Mm-hmm. And if you're running a fever, an antibiotic. If you're not running a fever, then you don't need an antibiotic.
Right.
Because there's no infection. So that's the problem in medicine. It's driven not only by nutrition, it's driven by big pharma. And the reason I say it's driven by nutrition is because if you're not selling and making money, you can't feed your family. So nutritionally, mm-hmm. you know, medicine makes a big difference in a healthcare provider's practice. Mm-hmm. But going back to what the dog does and how the dog does it is, for you to know that you've been triggered, you have to get past the point of the threshold of adrenaline, cortisol, neurotransmitters being reached to put you into the fight or flight symptom, mm-hmm. that anxiety feeling. With the dog in his nose, he can actually smell the adrenaline, the cortisol, as it's released into the system about a minute to 2 minutes after the trigger occurs. Mm-hmm. Because the dog is so responsive to being a member of the pack rather than being the pack leader, they accept the pack role very, very, very welcomely. They can tell that if you're triggered, you're not going to be pack leader because there's something in your system and you're going to lose track of it. Excuse me. By you learning what the dog is telling you when you've been triggered, your body has the chance and the opportunity to release the oxytocin, serotonin, endorphins, and dopamine that will counteract the adrenaline and cortisol neurotransmitter before it ever reaches the threshold level. Mm-hmm. Stop the attack, the episode? Absolutely not. But it will minimize it because it doesn't have a chance to fully develop into the fight or flight syndrome. When you notice that you're anxious and you're hypervigilant and you interact with your dog, it takes you maybe 5 to 10 minutes to start calming down. You take a big, deep cleansing breath and then you interact with the dog. But it's still taking it because you've got a full head of adrenaline and cortisol in the system circulating. Mm-hmm. So it does take you a long time to, you know, like I said, 10 minutes to calm down, but then you're able to catch yourself and you're back to normalcy. With the dog, because you're proactively responsive and releasing the oxytocin, serotonin, endorphins, and dopamine earlier on into the episode, then you're really taking control of and minimizing the effect of what the memory that's going to be surfacing is. Mm-hmm. It's not going to stop it. It will go ahead and minimize it to where it becomes an afterthought, not taking hold of your life for a period of time. And most organizations don't allow their dog to be proactively responsive during the training because then the dog will bond with the trainer. This was seen evidently in some trainings that were going on up in Washington with a national known service dog organization, which they were using members of the PTSD clinic to train service dogs for veterans that really needed dogs, and which is kind of a oxymoron there.
Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt for a second and explain to the listening audience what we're talking about is third-party training, where an organization fully trains a service dog, and fully trains is in quotes, versus what I've defined as cooperative training, where the veteran is personally involved in training his dog. So like Bart was saying, the dogs bond to their trainer. They bond to the person who is with them the most, who gives them leadership, gives them commands and rewards. If that is not the person who the dog is then supposed to go work for, it can create a lot of confusion. And I've had many people contact PTS Dog complaining that, well, you know, I got a dog from such and such organization, but it didn't work out. And when I ask why it didn't work out, well, the dog and I weren't bonded. There was no connection. The dog didn't, I mean, the dog obeyed just fine, but it didn't work for me. It just did what I told it. And that's, you know, that's a difference in approach, and especially for PTSD service dogs. In my opinion, if you don't have your hands on training the dog to respond to you, to help with your symptoms, the dog's unable to be very effective. How can you, Bart, train a service dog for me when you don't know how my symptoms develop?
Well, it is possible, you know, and it does certainly work having a cookie cutter trained service dog. The problem with cookie cutter service dogs versus owner trained service dog is the fact of the reaction time to responding to the trigger, the episode. The dog that is cookie cutter trained is only taught to be reactive to the needs of the person when the person says, "Come here, buddy, I need you. I don't feel good. Mm-hmm. I feel anxious." Now, the unfortunate part is that that feeling is somewhere between 15 to 20 minutes after the trigger occurs.
Mm-hmm. Okay? After potentially having done or said something that you will come to regret.
Well, no, but I'm just saying that it's you're calling the dog to be reactive to you because you're in the middle of a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, because the dog then learns that, okay, this is where you want me to interact. This is where you want me to intervene. This is why people that have cookie cutter dogs will tell you that, yes, their dog helps them with their panic attack, you know, because they know they're having it when the dog comes up and tells them. But they've already gone past the fight or flight syndrome to initiate the contact.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden the dog's the smartest dog in the world because he's, you know, alerting him 2 minutes before he's in the middle of a panic attack, but that's where the person initiated that he wants the response from. So it's the dog's not turned off. The dog is only turned off at the triggering point.
Mm-hmm.
We don't turn the dog off on the triggering point. We have the dog turned on to the triggering point, and by turning on the human to be proactively responsive, we're responding at the triggering point and releasing that oxytocin, serotonin, endorphins, and dopamine 3 to 4 minutes after the trigger. But it's still 3 to 8 minutes before the point that the next person has their dog getting interceding. And mm-hmm. I'm more worried about what happens in the first 12 minutes to push you towards the brink of suicide or not suicide. That first 12 minutes could be the a killer there.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to take the chance. We don't want to go that, well, it's a 50-50 chance he's going to do it or not do it. Because people still commit suicide with their dogs in view, which is really bad for the dog because the dog is just freaked out.
Well, yeah.
And the thing about it is that, you know, somebody once asked me, well, why can't you just train a dog to prevent a suicide? It's like, and how many times are you going to be able to do that? Because if he's training with his battle buddy and the man, and he puts a gun to his head and there's a blank in there, and you teach the dog how to get in between the gun and the person, and you pull it, and the blank goes off, the person's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog thinks, oh, this is a new game we're going to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But what happens if he says, nah, he's all right, and he watches him pull the gun and the trigger, and the bullet goes through the brain and blood's all over the place. The dog goes, oh, shit, this was not part of my friend. This was really a bad deal. He really did kill himself. That's why the dog is usually, you know, just turned out and hopefully will become a companion dog for somebody else. He will never make another service dog. Yeah. You know, we hear more stories of the dog walking in as the veteran is holding the gun or holding a knife and places his body in between the veteran and, you know, the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Get away. And then bringing the person and licking the person, getting their attention to bring him back and say, oh, you're here. I'm sorry. You know, I didn't mean to try to kill myself in front of you. But, you know, like I said, but that occurs during that period of time, you know, leading up to that stress, you know, to where you're cognizant of it.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, the cookie cutter dog is reactive, but he's just not reactive soon enough to where it needs to be.
Yeah.
And it's because the dog is turned off. The dog is not allowed to bond with that trainer because of the, you know, the release of the adrenaline and cortisol. And that's what really causes the bondability between the dog and the person.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the group up in Washington, in the first 3 years, they were given their gold card access to the Walter Reed and Fort Belvoir. In 3 years, at the cost of $12 million, they were only able to go ahead and place 17 service dogs in a three-year period, which wow. amounted to approximately $800,000 per dog trained.
That's a little bit ridiculous.
Well, there was a lot of, you have to realize how many dogs didn't make it through the program, and only 17 made it.
Yeah.
But that was the total cost, and so, you know, that was kind of high. And then this past year, they were in 2017, they were invited not to be part of the Walter Reed program anymore. They had some dogs that were turned for behavioral issues and things like that, not bonding with the veterans. So, you know, it's. I mean, it does have a place for seeing eye dogs, for some true mobility assistance dogs. But when you're dealing with PTSD, you know, dogs to alert to triggerings and memories and things like this, you need a dog that can be more proactive.
Yes.
And you want a dog that's proactive, so that way, but proactive on the front end of the triggering, not on the reactive end of the triggering. Mm-hmm. Many times, and I'm sure you've run across it, somebody who has a seizure response dog, they tell you, oh, yeah. My dog alerts me that I'm going to have a seizure about 20, 30 minutes before I have it. And, you know, and they just wait for the seizure. And I always ask, well, what do you do between that? Oh, nothing. And if you can get proactively responsive into with your dog, you're going to go ahead and refocus your brain on the dog. Just not say, okay, you're letting me know I'm going to have a seizure. I might as well just wait for it. Mm-hmm. But if you can proactively respond to the dog, you might actually minimize the seizure down to where it just becomes a shudder or something, not a long acting, you know, because you're spending 30 minutes to get into the seizure, it's going to take you another 45 minutes or an hour to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So being proactively responsive with your dog is really is a better way of handling every situation. Like I said, it's not stopping the seizure. It's going to allow the seizure to go on, but it's not going to go ahead and make it as strong as it was. It's going to minimize it because yes. you've taken all the strength of it out of the seizure. You know, out of because you're not waiting 20 minutes for the seizure to explode. You're defusing the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog. My guest is Bart Sherwood, and you're listening to us on DV Radio, WDVR.
DB Radio is for our fellow brothers and sisters, and it's all free of charge for our listeners, our guests, and even those that have shows right here on DVRadio.net. We do everything in-house, from mixing and recording ads and shows to the website and all that you get from us. We love promoting veteran-owned businesses and highlighting those in the veteran community. So if you would like to continue to hear what we bring to you and have even more in the future with the best quality that we can possibly bring to you, please head over to DVRadio.net and click that PayPal donation button. Any amount is welcome, from $1 to $100 million that your uncle lets you in his trust fund. So please head over to DVRadio.net and click that PayPal donation button right now. Oh, ah!
Radio. MyDBStore.com. Bid will begin with item 69776. Can I get stickers?
Nope.
I gotta get over your country decaf. Get over your country decaf. Who here a t-shirt? Anyone with a t-shirt? Nope. I'm gonna make a name card. A crazy bastard t-shirt.
Nope.
Now I got a mug. DB mugs. I got mugs. Let me hear DB farm coins with DB coins. DB farm coins with DB coins. Gone once. Gone twice. Sold to MyDBStore.com.
Do you really want that smell of the springs of Ireland, or had your rudder had that manly scent? After that warm shower to start your day, then ditch the bar, grab the grenade. Head over to kmarsoapco.com and grab this all-natural soap, infused with ingredients like coconut, palm and canola oils, and other natural oils that won't harm your skin. So stop smelling like a glitter fairy and get your manhood back by ditching the bar and grabbing the grenade today. That's kmarsoapco.com.
Ever shop online at smile.amazon.com? Why not give back to the DV Farm by making it your charity of choice? No extra fees or hidden costs, and a portion of your purchase goes directly towards the DV Farm, located in Gilsum, New Hampshire, and helping to continue its mission. That's smile.amazon.com, and be sure DV Farm is your charity of choice. For more information about the DV Farm, please go to dvfarm.org.
Welcome back to the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog, right here on DV Radio, WDVR. In case you're just tuning in, I'm with Bart Sherwood, the founder and director of TADSAW, Train a Dog, Save a Warrior. And we're going to talk a little bit about those nonprofit organizations that are out there training service dogs. And this is something I've addressed on the PTS Dog Facebook page, Bart, but I encourage my readers, if they're considering going with a program, to take a look at that program and what it requires of the veteran. What can you tell me about that?
TADSAW, feels it's an honor and privilege to take care of a veteran's needs, period. You know, these are people, men, women, who have served our country, making sure that we all can stay safe at home and not be bothered by the enemy. Mm-hmm. And so I figure that they didn't charge me any time when they were on service because my taxes took care of it, or should have, and they didn't ask me for overtime pay. I feel that it's really an honor and privilege to take care of their needs. When they call, Their only charge for this program is the dog food, the normal dog costs, their travel back and forth to the trainers. There's no quid pro quo. You'll get a free dog if you'll help earn X number of dollars on a GoFundMe page. The only thing I'll tell them to do is, if somebody asks how to make a donation, just tell them to go to the TADSAW website. But we don't ask our veterans for any kind of money at all. Up front, there's no application fee. When somebody's asking for an application fee, it's okay, so you're not going to make it through the application process, but you're going to collect $25 or whatever. And when I talk to some of these organizations about the application, if they can't afford an application fee, they probably can't afford a dog. And it's like, they probably need the dog. They may not be able to afford it, but they sure could use the help on it. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're about, helping the veteran get the dog. And hopefully everything else falls in line for the veteran. But I always tell them that if you're going to look for organizations, check them out, see what their funds are. If you go and start looking at the financials, You know, when you see a company that's got, you know, $500,000 in expenses, $6 million in donations, and where's the other $5.5 million at? You know, it means that somebody's putting money away somewhere. You don't need a big expensive facility to train a service dog. You know, most of these dogs that are trained in these cookie cutter places have really nice facilities, nice dog kennels, big ice office buildings, things like this. Well, no matter how much money they say doesn't go into the building and land and everything else, it goes into the building and the land and everything else, and and a little bit it goes towards the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to one of these facilities, you're going there for 2 weeks to get your dog, or 3 weeks, and then you're going to go back home to your little town, and guess what? It's not the same place as you trained it. The dog is going through a culture shock because now he's going to a new place, and hey, we didn't prepare for this kind of home life. And so it's really important that you try to find a place that's close enough to your home that you and your dog can travel back and forth to, because that's where you're going to be staying. That's where you're going to go shopping. You're going shopping at your Petco, at your Tractor Supply, at your feed store, at your grocery store, not some big fancy grocery store where it has more food than you've ever seen possible. You know, 15 different types of beans. You know, when your grocery store carries two types, you know, whole beans and refried beans, you know. So, I mean, it's you need to be going and training where you're going to be living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's about. It's about getting you a battle buddy to be there for you and to go shopping with you and be part of the scene with your family, with whatever. It's not about training in some fancy location and then, you know, you're never going back to New York City or wherever, because that's not your comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's about being in your comfort zone. But going back to choosing an organization, you want to know what their success rate is, how the training technique is, what is your part of, what is your obligation to the program, what is the program's obligation to you?
Mm-hmm.
Do they work with you or do they work against you? You know, you're training with your newest battle buddy, you know, and you're going through basic training with them. This is what you're supposed to be looking for. One of the things I do when somebody asks me how much, after they read all the information, they go to our website, they still want to know how much it's going to cost them because they don't believe, you know, it says no charge. And a lot of times I'll tell them that, you know, if you promise not to cry, I'll tell you how much the cost is. But you got to promise you're not going to cry. And it doesn't matter whether they've worn the beret, whether they went to ranger school, or they're a spouse. When I tell them there's no charge, they still choke up, even after they promise not to cry. I guess it's the sadist in me that, you know, I want them to smile and feel happy about something, because most of the people coming to get a dog, most of the veterans, they've been up and down the road a long time, and they're just broken.
Yeah.
And they need the fixing. You know, when you join the military, they give you a weapon, they give you a uniform, and then they tell you the guy next to you is your battle buddy. And so you train and you go through the military with your weapon, your uniform, and your battle buddy. And you serve all the years, maybe with different battle buddies, but you still have a battle buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come out, they take away your uniform, which you're now happy to put on shorts and cutoffs and wear sandals or sneakers or whatever. They take away your weapon, which that's no big loss because you've got a cache of confiscated weapons that you were able to funnel back into the United States while you were serving. And you don't have to worry about going and buying ammunition because you got plenty of that too. But that's all hidden stuff, and that's fine, you know. You are the weapon, so why they worry about taking away your guns is stupid. But they take away your battle buddy, and for the first time, you're left alone trying to figure out, how am I going to take care of myself? I don't have anybody that's got my six. Your family's not your six. Your friends aren't your six. And when you go to counseling sessions, these are guys that were just like your battle buddies that you don't have anymore, and you really are not looking to make a new relationship because you were down that same trail with those other battle buddies. And you lost some got hurt, you know, and you just don't want to have that close relationship. So the dog fulfills that battle buddy because he's unconditional, non-judgmental. You know, he's there because of you. And so now you bonded to your new battle buddy. And that's why we call him a K-9 battle buddy. And it makes a difference, because now you're safe again. You're able to do things like you used to do. And as you go through the program and you go through with your battle buddy, you start getting that more and more of that confidence, that self-esteem, that self-trust in yourself, that you can make a decision. Having a service dog is the closest thing to healing with PTSD that you can get. You're always going to have the memories, but it's going to be as close as being in control of them as you could were in control of life before you went in the military.
Yeah.
And it's about being able to recall those memories to, you know, to get there. But we're off way offline on as far as organizations. Organizations to me means, what has the organization done to benefit your brothers and sisters? What kind of waiting time is there? I mean, do I have to wait a year, 2 years? Do I have to be prostrate myself in front of a panel to show why I need a service dog? You being a veteran and saying I serve should be enough of a message to the organization that says, okay, you deserve a dog. I don't need to know why. You know, you tell me you're surviving with it. Your healthcare provider tells me you're surviving with it, with problems. I don't need to know what the problems are. I just need to know that you're going to be committed to training with your dog and working with your dog. So I would say how easy is the application? How non-invasive is it? Our application is pretty standard. I mean, they ask where you served, where you deployed, are you surviving with PTSD or TBI? And then it goes into a whole host of questions like, what do you think of dogs? What would you do with your dog? You know, it has nothing to do with the military. It just wants to know, what kind of relationship are you going to have with your new battle buddy? And so, you know, you want an organization that's really not trying to find out what your life history was in the military. Because if they're asking you to describe and explain how you were a victim, a survivor of PTSD, and what happened to you, there's an agenda there somewhere along the line, whether it's writing a book about your story to tell somebody else. We just kind of feel it's none of our business. You want to tell us what your, you know, what your situations were, that's fine. I'll listen, but I'm not going to ask. You want somebody that takes care of, you know, your friends also. I think, you know, Joaquin, you know, our biggest thing that I turned you on to is demographics. What's the demographics of the organization? How many females have gotten a service dog, you know, in comparison to the number of males veterans that have gotten service dogs? How many minorities, you know, your brothers and sisters are taken care of by an organization, to know that they're being taken care of, just not, you know, you or somebody else. You know, and those things are very important. I brought it up with the VA on the giving of benefits to a certain organization and their dogs, not in relation to the veteran that needs the assistance, but to the organization that provided the dog, which is totally off base. And when I brought up the question of demographics, it caught them by surprise, because they had no idea.
Yeah,
they had no idea what the numbers were. And, you know, and I'm proud to say, you know, Tatsaw, you know, has a pretty good set of demographics and numbers as far as even teams in the 8 years that we've been doing this. But it's not Tatsaw's success that counts. It's the success that the veterans and the trainers have given us in their buying into the program. That's what makes Tatsaw successful. It's not me.
Yeah.
I just came up with the idea and have been pretty strong about maintaining the goals of the program.
The bottom line with a program is, what's their goal? It's either help veterans or make money. Which program do you want to align with?
It's very true. You know, it may be a pretty program, but are their dogs any better? You know, my dogs range from, you know, mutt bred type chihuahua sized dogs all the way up to Great Danes and Bull Mastiffs. But they're all treated the same way. You know, we don't tell the chihuahua that he's, you know, a small dog. I often tell my donors when I make a presentation that, you know, we have chihuahuas in there, but we don't call them chihuahuas. We call them mini Great Danes, because they don't know how big they are. Mm-hmm. You know, damn well, I don't want to tell a chihuahua that he's a little bitty dog and have him bite my ankle.
Yeah.
You know? So you know, it's not the size of the dog. It's the heart of the dog that's inside that dog that mm-hmm. makes it a service dog, and what kind of relationship it has with its owner, with its veteran.
Yes. That I can't. It's a thing that I say over and over again when I write about service dogs. It's the bond formed between the veteran and the dog is what creates a successful team. Training is important, absolutely. Teaching the dog to behave in public, not to be reactive, that's absolutely vital. But you're not going to get there if you do not have that deep, strong bond between the veteran and his service dog. That bond is the basis upon which all the other training is built.
Most definitely.
So, just because we're talking, because you are the head of TADSAW, tell me a little bit about how many service dog teams TADSAW has produced.
Well, if you had called me yesterday, I could have told you it was 848 teams across the country.
Mm-hmm.
But since you called me this morning, I can tell you that during the day yesterday, we had two more teams graduate, one in Massachusetts and one in Norfolk, Virginia, to give us 850 service dog teams across the country.
And
of
that's...
which are 633 male veteran service dog teams and 217 female veteran service dog teams. So,
and that's in how many years?
That's since July 2010. Our first dogs were certified, I guess it was November 29th in 2010. We had three mm-hmm. dogs graduate from the program.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but since July 2010, we've had 850. I've got, I think, three or four more teams graduate, taking their test today mm-hmm. Up in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite an honor to realize that, you know, that the program has grown that much and, you know, has representation all over the country.
Yes, yes. I think that's one of the things that I find most unique and interesting about TADSAW is that you're not local. You're national.
Right.
It's a, for lack of a better way to describe it, it is a coalition of trainers spaced all across the country who use your program to help veterans. It's not one trainer who travels or anything like that. How many trainers do you have active right now?
About approximately 120.
Wow. Well,
are they all
in different cities, or do you have, like, some cities have three or four?
Well, Knoxville, Tennessee, I have two trainers in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've got three, but one of them is always... One of them goes in between the Virgin Islands and Tennessee, so I never know where she's at. in a place like Waco, you know, Fort Hood, Texas, I only have one trainer, and she's overwhelmed. And you know, we really need about three up there. I had two trainers, kind of. They got their own ideas about their way they train, and our methodology is pure positive reinforcement, no mm-hmm. negative reinforcement technique, no prong collars, no e-collars. We want this bond between the dog and the person to really exist because of love of each other. We don't want a dog who's, well, if I don't do this, then I'm going to be punished.
Right.
So that's not the way a service dog bond can be.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of, they didn't quit the program because she wasn't going to be told what kind of equipment she could use. And the other one I just kind of phased out because he was more into growing and getting bigger and wanting more and more to become his own entity of a dog training program. But he uses e-collars, you know, and believing that that's the way to train dogs. And even though he didn't use the collars for our veterans, I think, you know, it's kind of hard to maintain, you know, positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement training techniques.
Yeah.
Before you finally just give up and say, you know what, I'm going to go with this way. I don't care what the dog wants.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
And that's a debate. That's a debate. You know, that's a real touchy subject.
Not really. It's a touchy subject only on the fact of those who believe in it. You can make a dog do anything, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you use the right tools. The thing about it is that even though you make them do it, doesn't mean they want to do it. They're being forced to do it.
Right.
The service dog is usually born to be a service dog. He's a dog that's going to drop out of the pack because he'd rather smell the flowers underneath the tree, kind of like Ferdinand. He's the dog that wants to be by your side. He really doesn't care about other dogs. Mm-hmm. You know, you happen to have a dog that's basically not in his characteristic of his breed. You know that.
Oh, I know. Skeeter is very unique.
We talk about that all the time. That, you know, he is your first and last. Because you know you won't be able to find another one like them because they're just too bullheaded.
They're stubborn. They're stubborn. But
and you need a dog that's not going to be stubborn, mm-hmm. that's going to be more sympathetic to the person's needs mm-hmm. than his own needs, and that's unselfish.
Well, but, you know, at the time when I trained him, I needed a stubborn dog to stand up to me at my worst. And he did. And that has evolved to us being able to function and work together very smoothly and almost silently. And because he was stubborn at that time, I learned to pick up his alerts and how to respond in myself, how to respond when he alerted in order to avoid getting to that point where it was all over and I lost it. Right. But now that Skeeter and I have developed that, that kind of a smooth, quiet teamwork, I don't need a stubborn dog anymore. And he's learned that he doesn't need to be stubborn anymore until he does.
It took him a long time to train you. Remember that?
Yeah, exactly. It did take him a long time to train me.
And that's what I'm saying. Service dogs are not made. Okay, you can make a service dog to do things, mm-hmm. but if they're doing it because they're forced to, it's not a thing of love. It's just a job.
Yeah,
you know, and service dogs are born. You know, the only thing you're going to train a service dog to do is how to do sit, down, stay, leave it. You're going to teach them how to be able to do all the obedience commands necessary, mm-hmm. and you're going to be able to teach them how to do some tasks. Mm-hmm. But as far as that human canine bond gene, you can't teach them that. Yes, you can tie a pork chop around your neck for the dog to be friendly with you. And as soon as the dog pork chop's gone, you know, he's gone. Mm-hmm. You know, likes you as long as you got the pork chop. You know, we use treats to train. One, it's because it's an easy thing to make a dog, you know, bend to you and do things. And it's not trying to do two things at one time, like do a clicker and do a treat and things like that, which some veterans just don't have the propensity to do, you know, using a clicker. I mean, I'm not, you know, in the same situation, but I just have a hard time realizing, you know, trying to use a clicker or trying to use a treat bag. That's two things in two hands. You know, what are you reaching for first? Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, it's just easier to teach a veteran to say, yes, good boy, pat him on the head and give him the treat, or give him the treat first and then go through the touching tactile stimulation to release that oxytocin, saying good boy, so he hears it, mm-hmm. and the rub on his neck, and then he associates that he did something right.
Right.
Dogs are very smart. They learn very quickly. You know, it could probably take a trainer probably less than 5 weeks to train a service dog from start to finish, including most of the tasks that a veteran would use. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate part of this program is it takes the veteran 25 weeks to learn how to operate the dog and listen to the dog. So, right.
And that's it. Yeah, and that's the key, is you're really not training the dog that much. You're training the veteran
correct.
How to handle the dog. And that's a point that I've made, also a point that I hit on, is that handling your dog is an active undertaking.
Well, you're in training. You're always in. You go from, when you enter our program, you have an in-training service dog. Mm-hmm. And you go through the program, teaching all the obedience that's necessary, all the tasks that you want the dog to do, you know, how to be responsive to your dog and picking up on all his body language. And when you take your public access temperament test, and You know, the public access temperament test just measures a dog's proficiency, its ability to function in public setting. It does not actually test the task that you need the dog to do for you, because the laws don't have you to prove that what the dog does or show what your dog does. So it's really an ability of the dog's obedience out in public. And the yes, the dog can pass it, but we're really measuring proficiency of the team. Can the team work together and understand how to correct itself if there needs to be a correction?
Right.
So you're measuring the team's proficiency, just not the team's ability.
Right.
And so once you pass this test, you go from an in-training service dog to now a service dog team that's in training. Because every day you walk out of your house, you're going to be taking a public access test. Mm-hmm. No matter how you look at it, when you walk into the store for the first time, the dog is being scrutinized, and you're scrutinizing your own dog to see how he's going to behave.
Yep.
And so you're always testing your dog, going through it, and it's not a test. It's really testing your proficiency on handling the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So you never stop learning how to handle your dog.
Dogs grow and change just like people do.
Correct.
So you may need to take a different approach to a certain issue or problem once the dog's 6 years old, as opposed to when it was 2 years old.
Correct.
So really, the successful TADSAW trainer trains themselves out of a job.
I should hope so. I would hope that we can train ourselves out of a job. I mean, I don't like doing this because I think we need to be attached, you know, taking care of the service member before he gets out with the problems. I would love to see them just, you know, have the service dog when they're on active duty and learn how to have a dog around their house, so that way the dog is taken care of. And here we are, we're going to get into a point now where somebody's going to call you and say, all you're doing is training an emotional support dog. Well, you know what? We're in business for our clients. We're not in business to make other organizations feel good about themselves or the government. We're in the business to take care of our clients' needs. Mm-hmm. And if the dog is going to go ahead and alert you that you've been triggered for an anxiety attack, a depression cycle, whatever, and that's one of your emotions that come out, okay? Well, guess what? Emotional support now becomes a task for the service dog and the person.
Mm-hmm.
And all this leads to the other problem of all these organizations and all these healthcare facilities, especially the VA, when they tell somebody, well, all you need is an emotional support animal, they can take care of your needs. They're half right and they're all wrong. Because the emotional support animal builds that bond with that veteran just the same as a service dog. The only difference is you don't have any training for that dog when he goes out into the public area.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you take your dog out as a veteran, you may have a loaded gun with you if you get triggered and you don't pay attention to your dog when he's trying to tell you you're triggered.
Mm-hmm.
So all this deal about, well, an emotional support dog will do the same thing, it won't. It will only do it when it's alerting you that you're triggered for an emotional problem and you interact with it. That becomes a task. Mm-hmm. Why we're so worried about definitions and all this stuff as far as different organizations and pointing fingers is we're here to take care of our veterans. We're not here to take care of the needs of another organization.
Yeah.
If they want to call my dog an emotional support dog, that's great. And I'll accept it because guess what? Emotional support, we consider a task.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want me to take care of your anxiety, your depression, your bipolar outbreak. Great, that's a task for the dog now. So let's put it where it is any dog that does something for a human in combination with the person that's on the end of the leash, that's a service dog. If you have a dog that's interacting with somebody else and you're handling the dog, then you're a therapy dog.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. These emotional support animals, they're just a companion dog, as long as you don't take them out of the house. But as soon as they step outside, then they need to have the rules of the land, you know, taking care of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things imposed upon the service dog, and yet the veteran with the service dog is always looked down as far as, why do you need a dog? You know, is he a real service dog or is he a fake service dog?
Yeah.
And we talked about this, that as soon as a disabled person puts a leash in his hand, his dog is a service dog. Why? Because that's what the guidelines of the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, says. A person who is disabled can have a service dog.
Mm-hmm.
Has to have a diagnosis that would be corrected, you know, that would show an improved quality of life for that person with a dog, a service dog. So as soon as you touch the dog, whether he's well behaved or not, if he's not well behaved, then he's a really bad service dog. He's not a good representative of any kind of program. And you also have to look at the guidelines of the ADA, is that a dog cannot be a physical or health threat to any individual in the public setting.
Right.
So if your dog is misbehaving, then he is a threat to somebody. He's a threat to you. He's a threat to others. Therefore, he doesn't have the right of access. He is denied the right of access.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use the excuse, well, he's a service dog, he can act wrong. It's no, he's a service dog, he has to act accordingly.
Yeah.
Your dog can be dirty, fucking scratching all the time because maybe he has a skin disease that could be transmissible. You know, he's got to have his rabies shot so he's not, you know, biting somebody and causing rabies to spread. So, like I said, the dog can't be a physical or a health threat to anybody. And so, as long as you utilize the guidelines, then everybody with a service dog, a veteran, is going to be fine. And any other person is going to be fine. The freak service dog, and the reason they're not covered under the ADA, is that service dogs in training are not covered as far as the right of public access.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's in there is because of the fact you have many nonprofit organizations and businesses that make a living on the backs of disabled persons by training service dogs for them. And those people that are doing the training, whether they're volunteers or the trainers themselves, are not disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And the ADA is protecting the rights of the disabled by saying, hey, if you're training service dogs and you're not disabled, it's not a service dog. You don't fall into the protection of the ADA.
Right.
And every one of our veterans that's in the program training a dog for themselves is a disabled veteran. He's got a disability rating. He's been recommended for a service dog by his health care provider.
Mm-hmm.
Whether psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist, primary care physician, social worker, whoever. That's pharmacists even have recommended dogs. It's, you know, it's being recommended in as a treatment to improve that person's quality of life.
Yes.
So right then and there, it is a service dog, and he is in training, but he's going to be in training for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning part. So they can't really, you know, take you out and not allow you to have your dog there. All you need to do is excuse yourself from the place where you are because of the fact your dog's not acting appropriately.
Yeah.
Most good service dog owners and handlers are going to go and say, you know what, he's just off today, we're going to leave.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, come back.
Well, that's all the time we have. Bart, thank you so much for joining me. You can find contact information at what website?
Our website is www.tadsaw.org. That's www.t as in Tom, A as in Alpha, D as in dog, S as in Sam, A as in apple, W as in whiskey.org.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate having you on the show. You've been listening to the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog right here on DV Radio, WDVR.